Testing. 1, 2, 3, testing.
This is Leon Gortler. I'm talking with Henry Taube on the way to Grand Central Station on March 19th, 1986. We'll try this and hope the batteries hold out. You already answered the question of why you left Cornell for Chicago. I guess it just wasn't stimulating enough.
I don't know whether... I don't know yet whether I would have continued that there if I had continued. I think my chances were perhaps good. But the fact was, I didn't enjoy the environment, and I really wanted out. I was attracted to these other places. Yeah. I thought that life could easily be more fun. Oh, I should mention that Cornell also was run under the German system. I didn't spend much time on Cornell because, in fact, it was probably, if I choose any of the places, I've been the nadir of my career. And one of the things that I didn't like at all was that, in contrast to Berkeley, it was highly compartmentalized. There was an inorganic and analytic and an organic and a physical division. And mine, particularly the inorganic division, was run on a sort of rather strict authoritarian style.
I see.
And I didn't really get along with the man that ran it. This is not for publication. I simply did not respect him as a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not even respect him as a teacher. I didn't think he understood chemistry. He had a responsible position there.
It was, in fact, the physical chemist who had, from Cornell, who had sort of built this minor empire. He was the fellow who, I think, started the Journal of Physical Chemistry.
He wasn't. He was emeritus by the time I got there.
Yeah.
And the name would come back. He was a colloid chemist.
Apparently.
You remember that? I think he was.
No.
It was called Physical and Colloid Chemistry.
I see.
I think.
Uh huh.
Yeah. And the name might come to
that. He died
during the time I was there, but he was quite elderly.
Sort of always kind of at loggerheads with the Berkeley School of Physical Chemistry.
Yes,
they really
yes.
saw things quite differently.
That's,
I think
that
he was more of a classicist.
I haven't thought of him for many years, but the name of the bank. In fact, I know that I have a phonograph record in my collection that came out of his estate.
I see.
Because he got disposed of some of the things that they thought were drunk. So I do have this little bit of a connection with him. It's a shame I can't remember his name. But you remember.
Yes,
we're thinking about the same.
Yeah, I have a thesis on my desk.
I don't want to leave the impression that I was socially unhappy. I was not. I have dear friends there now. Lynn Horton and I, both Hortons, are very dear friends of mine, always will be. And Cy Bauer was among the few who would ask me a question about what I was doing. No, in fact, I would say that apart from my friend Rubin, whom I mentioned, that Cy Bauer was the only one who ever came up to me and said, "What are you doing today? What are you doing?"
And that was so different from what you'd had at Berkeley.
In a sense, it couldn't have been a greater contrast. I obviously believe that the Berkeley system, where it can be practiced, is better.
I was concerned when, you'll even see my doubts in the article about why Berkeley, where Lewis had, set the stage for the whole bonding theory and what have you, always was rather weak in organic chemistry. And some people say that Lewis hated organic chemists. The organic chemists on the staff were people who had invariably gotten degrees with him until Calvin arrived, and then in the 40s, 1940s, they hired some real organic chemists with the others. And I wonder if you had any feeling about that, or if you were just a student.
Well, I think there was the feeling that he didn't really appreciate the synthetic organic chemist skill. And he really had the feeling that all chemistry was physical chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And the synthetic organic chemist wouldn't appreciate thermodynamics, for example, in a way that he thought that every person who called himself a chemist should have. So he probably did have unreasonable mindsets. And nobody would ever accuse us of being entirely reasonable in every department. He was opinionated, and he was arrogant, too.
Mm-hmm.
Could do all. But he had respect for all of us.
When you went to Chicago, you joined the chemistry department, did you also have an appointment at the institutes?
No, I was one of the ones that was brought in solely for the department. And having two classes of citizens caused a bit of a problem. And we were treated as second-class citizens. We were not members of the institute. I didn't really learn how badly until I was chosen by my colleagues to be the next chairman.
Okay, you followed Warren Johnson.
That's correct. And it was rather embarrassing for Warren. Warren was a friend and a good supporter, because before he sort of turned over the reins of office and he called me in and said, "Well, Henry, I'm in sort of an embarrassing position. As chairman, you're going to look at the books. You're going to see that your salary isn't commensurate with that of other people who are in the institute."
I see.
But I adjusted it because, I know that it's difficult to keep things fair, and even an administrator does what he needs to keep the institution going.
Right.
And, of course, I got a big boost in salary when I became chairman. I thought that, on the whole, I was treated well enough. I never went in and asked for a raise.
Did the chairman of the chemistry department wheel and deal for the people in the institutes as well, or was that a totally separate unit?
No, I think actually, I don't really know how that, but I should remember how that was done, because I was chairman for a while. I think they had separate budgets, so in a sense, of course, he had no real responsibility, if that were true. I just don't remember. But I know that this point that I've raised helped me enormously as chairman, because an ordinary expression, I sort of had Warren by the short hair. And he was very generous during my term of chairmanship in providing support for the department. He was very good to us. He found money when I thought none existed.
He was dean for
He became dean, yes. That's
of
right.
The,
yeah, I should have mentioned
that. Yeah. Right. No, I knew that, but I couldn't remember quite what dean he was.
Is there anything to make a name? I was really a very poor chairman in the sense that I didn't understand budgets. I'd really had no administrative experience before, but at least the department didn't fall apart while I was chairman. And I think the credit for it surviving probably belongs to Warren, because I think in a real sense, he did part of my job for me.
I see. Of course, that has been a hard position to handle, because Hutchins was gone already by the time you became chairman. Is that right? I think Kempton was probably president at that time.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
There was a very long period from Stieglitz to Johnson where the department had no chairman at all in Chicago.
Oh, and, uh, that was during the war years.
No. Oh. It was from approximately 1933 to 1945 or 46.
I didn't know that.
He absolutely refused to appoint a chairman from within the department, and there was an enormous search, and I found in the archives lists of people who were considered for the position, a number of Europeans.
So Hutchins didn't trust his own faculty.
I think it may have been that he didn't care for Karas at all. I mean, Karas was a logical choice. Yeah. Schlesinger essentially ran the department during that whole period. There was essentially a troika running the department for a number of years of Karas, Harkins, and Schlesinger. And Schlesinger was essentially the chairman of the committee, so he ran the department, but he never had the... the way Grant Urey tells it, that Hutchins absolutely refused to appoint Schlesinger chairman, too. I can't remember quite what it was that he had against him, but I think...
When I was first interviewed at Chicago, Schlesinger was acting in place of a chairman.
That's right. So there was no chairman. Johnson had not been appointed yet.
Correct. And by the time I got there, Johnson was chairman.
Okay.
And in the interim between being invited and being appointed, I actually got a raise in salary. Because Schlesinger, I think, tended to follow Stieglitz's tradition of saving the administration money,
right.
Which was brought up. I mean, nothing against them.
Mm-hmm.
He believed that, well, we shouldn't be spent with, and they could buy me at that. And I was happy to come up. I was so pleased to learn, and surprised that I learned it was Bill Libby who had a look at the books, and I guess Libby probably compared mine with Clyde, Hutchison, and some others, and decided that they weren't paying me enough. But I have no bitterness to Chicago about salary questions at all. During my entire time there, even though I've mentioned it, that wasn't one of the things I worried about.
Oh, okay. What were the conditions like in Chicago when you got there in terms of facilities and laboratories?
Well, my requirements at the beginning were very modest. I had done experiments often falling rates by simple titration.
Mm-hmm.
Spectrophotometers were not yet universally available. I did acquire a Beckman spectrophotometer rather soon after arriving there, and I don't remember whether... I probably got that through the ONR, because my first research support came from them. And that was during the good old days when they came to the universities and they asked people to please accept some support. I mean, we'd like to support some of your research.
I see.
And then a little bit later, the AEC came into the picture, and I was given a mass spectrometer by them. And in that respect, I have, again, no complaints whatever. My needs continued to be modest. In fact, I had a very difficult time adjusting to the new ways, because I thought you were begging for support.
Yeah.
And I wondered about other people who should have been supported who weren't getting support. It took me a while to get used to the new ways. And the mass spectrometer stood me in very good stead, because it allowed us to do a number of stable isotope tracer and isotope fractionation experiments.
Was this one that Urey had built, or was this
it was a commercial instrument.
Uh-huh.
And it was very good. I think that its precision was about only three times worse than the refined machine that Urey's group put together, which I understand gave accuracy at the level of electronics of those days. They had really taken everything out of it. You just couldn't do anything better with the electronics. But Urey had a magnificent mass spectrometer. He needed very precise size conditions.
Right.
As I remember, it would be 1 part in 10 to the 4th for 0.18 of natural level, something of which you had.
Oh, boy.
And I think our mass spectrometer would be quite a bit short of that.
Mm-hmm.
We're certainly useful for isotopic tracing work. And was very useful for the first measurement of the number of water molecules that are bound by a cation in the aqueous solution.
How in the world did you do that by mass spectrometer?
Well, I had, in the course of giving my course, I had deduced that water molecules would stick to chromium ion, that they would exchange slowly, and of all of the ones that were sort of accessible, I chose that as the one most likely to yield an interesting result. You know, now people ask, why was that a significant experiment? What many may not appreciate is that in those days, many physical chemists thought that all reactions of inorganic ions will produce seeming term instantaneous in freshman books. You know, they would be very, very rapid. And when John Hunt, who undertook to do the measurements, started to work with me, we didn't have a mass spectrometer. And the idea was that you would take a solution containing hexachlorchromic ion, dissolved in ordinary water, and then you would spike it with a given amount of water enriched in OAT. And you'd, of course, get instantaneous dilution of the OAT isotope by the free water. But you wouldn't get dilution by the water that's bound to the chromic ion. If no water were held back by the chromic ion, you'd get a certain value. The O18 the ratio of the 18 to O16 would be a certain value.
Right.
If, on the other hand, the chromic ion held back 6 waters,
yes,
the isotopic enrichment would remain higher.
Right.
And by looking at that difference, you could then determine the...
Very clever experiment.
And it was an important experiment, and I've heard physical chemists of my age acknowledge it publicly, saying that they were astonished that an inorganic alkaline would be so slow to undergo substitution.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the study of hydration of ions continues to this day. We did some of the very easy ones.
Mm-hmm.
And people are doing the important hard ones now. Now I see. Collection of.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Let me stop for just a minute. See, I hope the batteries hold out. These were. Who were the people you interacted with most at Chicago? Say something about the people on the staff there.
I think with Frank Westheimer, that's very easy. Because each of us understood what the other was trying to do, and it was different enough so that, you know, it had sort of a fresh flavor.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you look at Frank's early review article on the chemistry of chromium 6, oxidation of chromium 6, you'll note that he acknowledges me in the appropriate section. And I participated in all those discussions. I learned an awful lot from them. And I learned especially to appreciate Frank's precision of thinking, which certainly didn't allow any sloppiness in his thinking. And then it turns out that Libby and I had known each other since Berkeley days. In fact, my first wife and his then wife, Laura Lee, were very good friends. And I knew the family. And I was always easy in Bill Libby's presence. Billy B was interested in electron transfer reactions, that he obviously understood the subject. There's nothing more to say about it. But I know that Bill also respected the work that I was doing. And he was a stimulating colleague. He'd ask you challenging questions. But he'd do it in such a manner that you knew he wasn't trying to put you down. He wanted to get a discussion going. And in fact, he did make an important basic contribution to the field of what's called, electron transfer reactions in chemistry. Because he was really the person who publicized the relevance of quantum restriction to the thermal electron transfer process. Now, Franck himself appreciated the relevance of the restriction, as did Katzmann, who was, a student of Franck. But Franck never pushed the idea, whereas Libby got up publicly and talked about it. And then he made another very important contribution. I think he was instrumental for organizing a symposium. It was held, I think, in 1952 at the Roman Catholic School in Indiana?
Notre Dame.
On electron transfer processes. And it had to be somebody with Libby's sort of broad view of things, because it dealt with electron transfer in the gas phase, theoretical and experimental, and then dealt also with sort of theoretical papers to the extent that one could theorize for the processes in condensed phase. He himself gave a paper. And down to rather detailed reports on what they call self-exchange processes now, and on some relatively simple oxidation-reduction reactions. Now, I didn't attend that symposium, but it had an enormous impact on the field, not so much, I'd say, for the papers themselves as for the discussion that ensued. And it's rather interesting that the idea, which, we all discussed among ourselves, that inorganic reactions might proceed like organic ones, that the thing that we call electron transfer might really involve atom transfer. That actually is documented, I think, for the first time in the literature in some comments that H.C. Brown made following a paper on the self-exchange rate between iron 2 and iron 3. Dodson and Silverman had measured the iron 2, iron 3 self-exchange for two of the halides and found that the reaction is more efficient when chloride mediates the reaction than when bromide. And one interpretation would be that these are bridging ions.
Yes.
And Brown even suggests that this is almost an expected order.
Uh-huh.
But at that time, there was no experimental proof of the validity of that this mechanism really obtained. And then a third mechanism, which belongs, obviously must be a controlling factor, so-called hydrogen atom transfer. I think nowadays we say electron motion equivalent to proton motion, because you have to move charge in solution. And that also, for the first time, I think, was enunciated as a theory. It was a very important meeting. I wasn't there, incidentally, but still it was important for my own work at home.
Mm-hmm. Who came into the department at that time?
Yes. Tremendous influx. You have to count the people in the Institute when I say that.
Right.
That came into the department proper. Perhaps I was the only one at that time.
Uh-huh.
But there were about five or six people of my age. Let's see if I can remember them. Norman Nocturne, Fred Hutchison, Tony Kirkovich, Nate Sugarman, Elliot, who then went to Brookhaven, Jake Beagle-Eisen. Well, I think there were two categories. There was a category of maybe instructor, assistant professor, and then there was a category of sort of a high-level postdoctoral fellow.
Uh-huh.
And I think Jake Beagle-Eisen was in that category, and Harold Dodgen and a few others. And these were all very, very good people.
Yeah, that's quite a cast.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I didn't get very far on people who showed special interest. But there we go to it. And it turned out that Karosh and I had a lot of interest in common because during my years at Cornell, I really worked on inorganic free radical reactions. So I knew quite a bit about Karosh's work.
Uh-huh.
And Karosh and Bill Urey and I, never together, but separately, had many interesting discussions on problems in chemistry. And I think Morris, had occasionally came to see me. I often came to see him. Schlesinger never, I think, had any feeling for my work. He was deeply involved in boron chemistry. But I know that Schlesinger was a very strong supporter of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I would guess that Frank Westheimer would have influenced him, and maybe Bill Libby. I know that Frank thought very well of my review paper in which I correlated rates of substitution with electronic structure. He never said anything to me directly, but somebody passed on a remark to Frank.
Well, that's true, and you passed a harsh judge. He really is a very quality-conscious person.
Yeah. But it's a paper that I continue to be proud of. It has to be read in the context of its time. When I was asked to give a paper at the Pauling birthday celebration, I thought that I might talk about Pauling and his contributions to inorganic chemistry, but I decided it would be difficult for me to do, because the success that I had in that paper depended on putting aside some implications of Pauling's view. I mean, I realized that the description of inorganic complexes as ionic and covalent didn't really go beyond the magnetic criterion that soon became apparent to me, that the ionic complexes could actually be easily more covalent than the ones he called covalent. That he was really talking about low spin complexes on the one hand, where all of the non-bonding orbitals were occupied. This is the modern language. And then complexes on the other, where some of the non-bonding orbitals were empty, or where you had antibonding electrons. And I saw that he was confusing covalency with rate of substitution, in effect.
I see.
So chromic ion is slow, and the correlation I introduced was done without understanding Ligand field theory, and I did it actually in the language of the bond theory. I simply pointed out that what you're talking about is rates, not equilibrium properties. And the correlation survived the change from valence bond theory to, let's say, Ligand field theory. It was a valid experimental basis. I think that those are the main people that I had anything to do with. But the fact is that simply as a member of a department, I was invited to give seminars in front of my colleagues. And I think that's the point that somebody, that's the thing that may not have been mentioned to you. it was a very important function in the early history of the chemistry department. I mean, this includes the chemists from the institute. And Bill Mayer had the idea of bringing all the chemists together on a Wednesday afternoon when coffee and cookies or donuts would be furnished. And then after people had had a chance to chat with each other, what they would do, Joe would look around the room and he'd pick out one of his colleagues and say, well, Mikey, Henry, we haven't heard from you before. Would you get up and tell us what you're doing in research? And it was wonderful. It was informal, and all of us, of course, were deeply immersed in research. And I remember starting to talk, and time went on, and I was asked to continue the next time, and I really felt very flattered. I mean, this is a tremendous contrast to Cornell, where I was never invited during my entire time to give a seminar to my colleagues.
Because you were there, you were...
I was an inorganic chemist.
Were probably, you know... If they were really Germanic, you were sort of fairly down to the table.
I was way down because I had very little contact with Dubai. Dubai would get in touch with Loudon here about being able to tell him what to do or think.
I see. Oh, my.
I did not admire Dubai as a chairman. And it was impossible to because, he did not fit my idea of the chairman of a department like the Department of Berkeley, but I guess for Cornell organizing it was comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
He did not, I have to say, take much interest in the younger colleagues, unless, of course, they were working close to his own interests.
Mm-hmm.
He felt no responsibility for that. And I think that when he was named, they pretty well understood what they would be getting, and I think it worked out well for him because he was a highly respected scientist, he was an extremely good scientist,
right.
And I think he did them a lot of good.
Did you get the impression in Chicago that there was sort of a philosophy that the organic chemists followed? That is, it was the one department that I've come across where there were no classical organic chemists in the sense that we think of classical organic chemists, you know.
It might have been the Stieglitz influence, I suppose.
Yes, and before him, but
yes,
we
would call physical organic chemists now, wouldn't we?
42nd Street exit closed.
That's
terrible. Oh, how ridiculous. Oh, my. All right. You're going to get a bigger ride.
What a shame. How far do you have to go now?
Well, I'll go to 61st Street and then come back.
Organic chemistry was pretty well full up when I was there because the institutes, as far as I can remember, saw no need to appoint any organic chemists. So the organic chemists...
Right.